Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum, and Jimmy Akin is here. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. More than 25 years an apologist.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Here.
Jimmy. Here. Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Were you apologizing before you came here? You must have.
I was. That's how I got the job.
Wait a second. I don't think I actually know where you came from directly before you came here. Like, what was your job right before the immediate job?
I was a philosophy teacher at the University of Arkansas.
I didn't even know that. That is, do you know what job I had right before I came here?
You worked at another radio station.
Yeah.
You worked at a radio station.
Yeah.
Doing a talk show.
Yeah, doing a talk show, right.
That's how you got this job.
Right. Right. That's exactly right, because they wanted me to – the public wanted me to talk less. So mm-hmm. they gave, so said, why don't you be the host of Catholic Answers Live? Let other people talk a little bit. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. I was never a cook. I've never been a cook in a Chinese restaurant. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but it would have been a safe guess. Not too many people have, although as you
know.
I know
a guy who was.
As you know, I am one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. 888-318-7884, the number. It's open forum. You can be Catholic and call. You can be not Catholic and call. You can be not sure whether you're Catholic or not. Anybody is welcome to call. 888-318-7884. And we welcome any question at all about the Catholic Church, the Catholic faith, Catholic beliefs. Or when Jimmy's here, we broaden that out to questions of a more generally religious or philosophical nature. If you've got those, give us a call. 888-318-7884. We go to Joe in South Dakota, listening to EWTN on Channel 130 Sirius Satellite Radio. Joe, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thanks, guys. Two-part question. First of all, are papal bulls infallible in part or in their entirety? And then maybe a little more specific, the 1452 Pope Nicholas papal bull, which some have suggested led to this doctrine of discovery. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on that and explain that a little bit? Thank you.
Okay. So first we need to talk about what a papal bull is, because people hear this word and they often don't have an idea of what one is beyond the fact that it's some kind of papal document.
Okay.
A bulla in Latin, the word originally like meant bubble. It got used metaphorically for the round lead seals that would be attached to important documents.
Oh.
And so a papal bull originally was any papal document that had one of these round lead seals that looked kind of like a bubble. And it's related to the word for boil. You can even hear that in English, you know, bulla.
Yeah,
same kind of root. And so because when things boil, they bubble. And so over the course of time, the seal didn't have to be lead. It could also be like red wax or even red ink. And really a bull doesn't tell you a whole lot about what the content of the document is. It's not like the word encyclical. Encyclical tells you this is a teaching document. Okay?
Yeah.
Bull just was anything sealed with a bull.
Oh, okay.
As a result, a wide range of different documents could be called bulls. Most papal documents today are not bulls. Although they occasionally will issue one, even with a lead seal, for special solemnity. Like when John XXIII called the Second Vatican Council, he used a bull with the fancy lead seal to do that. They do still occasionally get done, but really it's not so much a type of document as just a physical format. Consequently, since infallible papal statements are very rare, one should not look at a typical papal bull as being infallible. Scholars debate the exact number of papal documents that have exercised infallibility. on the low side, some scholars will say, will estimate it was only two. On the high side, some scholars have proposed, you know, around 12 or 14. Most scholars are kind of in the middle and think only like six or eight documents have exercised papal infallibility.
Okay.
And that's where, after looking at them, that's where I tend to settle out. I think it's in the middle. So it's actually, if you look at the thousands and thousands of documents popes have issued, and only six or eight of them have exercised infallibility,
mm-hmm.
very low percentage. So yeah. Do not assume that a document of this nature is going to be infallible, either in whole or in part, because the answer almost always is going to be no. In terms of the particular document that you're thinking of, it's a bull that was issued in 1452 by Pope Nicholas V called Dum Diversus, and it did deal with colonization, exploration, conquest issues, and people have used the phrase doctrine of discovery in connection with it. But we need to be really careful here, because in a Catholic context, the word doctrine means an official church teaching, something typically that has been derived from Christ and the apostles. And that's not what is meant in this context. As according to my understanding of this document, when people talk about a doctrine of discovery, they're not referring to a church teaching. They're referring to a policy.
Yeah.
Like when we use the word doctrine in a political context, we talk about the Monroe Doctrine or the Wilson Doctrine or the Reagan Doctrine.
Yeah.
All of these were policies that different American leaders implemented regarding foreign relations. And that's the kind of doctrine we're talking about here. It's not a church teaching. It's not a theological matter. It's a policy regarding the exploration and thus the discovery of various territories and relations with people who live there or who live in territories that Christians are coming in contact with and so forth. And so it wasn't it wasn't principally a teaching document. It was authorizing political leaders to implement certain policies in the age of exploration. And it's not enforced today as a result, as that age is long gone and all of the documents that authorized various things have lapsed in terms of legal force by this point, because canon law has been integrally reorganized.
Okay, Joe?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. 888-318-7884, the number. It's just 2 days left. You can still claim your free Kindle copy of Made This Way. Going to Made This Way, the Kindle page for Made This Way at Amazon.com. Coming up on 5,000 people have downloaded their free copy so far. So go to Amazon.com, look for Made This Way, and on its Kindle page, get your free copy today.
Hang on, we'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I love listening to Catholic radio. It's perfect. It provides peace and it builds us up and strengthens us. We listen to it whenever we're in the car. My husband and I love it. He got me started with it before he even became a Catholic. He owns his own business, and so he's working by himself, and he listens to Catholic radio. He's called in several times too. It's using the technology that we have for good.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Lots of folks on the line, but you can probably still get in if you give a call now, 888-318-7884. We go down to James in Richmond, Virginia, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Thanks for downloading the app. James, your question, please.
Hi, Jimmy.
So my question sort of has to do with the, I guess, whether or not to take Genesis literally when it's talking about, you know, the creation story. And again, Noah, everyone gets wiped out and starting over again. So basically we have, you know, clearly have different races right now. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Caucasians, Africans, Asians, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. How does that work within the creation story?
Well, this is a question that the Bible really doesn't answer, and so we can only deal with it by inference. But if you're taking, let's say you take a literal reading of Adam and Eve, so there's only two people. Well, hypothetically, they could have been of different races. I mean, you know, God may have flipped more than a Y chromosome to an X in creating Eve. So he could have flipped some additional chromosomes too. But that's not normally the approach that most people take. Also, if you assume that the flood is literally meant to be a universal deluge that wiped out everybody but Noah and his family, then that creates another population bottleneck through which only a limited number of genes can flow. And so there are basically a couple of options on those interpretations. One would be to say that the different human races arose between the – well, one would be to say they arose after the flood. And so consequently – everybody before that was the same race, whatever that might have been. The other interpretation would be to say that the races arose before the time of the flood, but they – and thus they developed out of the original line coming from Adam and Eve. But then the relevant genes were funneled – or at least some of them were funneled through the family of Noah, which as far as we're aware, at least the way the New Testament describes it, it had eight people. And so there have actually been – studies that that some people have done based on a literal reading of Genesis, where they look at the table of nations that follows the story of the flood, where the nations then spread out on the earth. And unfortunately, it's hard to do that because the table of nations is not a global document. It only deals with the nations that were known to Israel.
Yes,
right. But there were at least some that were known to Israel, you know, down in Ethiopia, Cush, to use the biblical name for it, that were darker skinned. And so if you look at the line of Ham, one of Noah's sons, you could say, okay, well, maybe Ham's wife was black or mm-hmm. something like that. So there have been attempts to figure out how the races could have gone through Noah's family based like on the wives of the sons. But it doesn't fit well with the historical scientific evidence and mm-hmm. and the biblical evidence, because the text is not trying to answer this question. And the way genealogies worked back then anyway, they weren't fully literal in that you could adopt different groups to create a legal relationship with them, just like we have adoption of individual people within families.
Yeah.
Back then, they would adopt entire tribes into a family relationship because it's a patriarchal society. Mm-hmm. So if you need a structure, you need a genealogical structure to tell everybody how to relate. And so if you're integrating a new tribe, you create a legal relationship. It gets adopted in.
Yeah.
So these genealogies weren't meant to be purely biological anyway. Like modern genealogies, they contained adoptions. And in fact, even on a larger scale than our genealogies tend to. Mm-hmm. There are challenges for trying to do this. If you take a fully literal understanding of these passages and you understand the flood as being universal and so forth. But there have been attempts, and the basic two attempts would be to say that the races arose after the time of the flood or before the flood, but then were funneled through the population bottleneck of Noah's family.
James, thank you very, very much for that question. We go now to Donald in Richmond, Virginia, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for downloading the app, Donald. Your question. Donald, do we have you there?
Yes, sorry. Yep, I heard a beep. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. Mm-hmm. The first one is that are there any churches that are like compatible with the Catholic Church? Like I've heard something about Eastern Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
And then second is, can there be any churches that are compatible, or can the Catholic Church be the only one that can be like the true church?
The answer to the question hinges in part on the meaning of compatible. That can mean different things. And the way the Catholic Church looks at it, there are various aspects of every community that are compatible with the Catholic Church, various aspects, you know what I say. So, for example, in the case of Eastern Orthodoxy, there are loads of things that are that Catholics and Orthodox agree on, and that are we're thus compatible on. They have the same sacraments that we do. They profess the same theology on almost every point. They have lots of commonalities with us, and so consequently, we're not quite in full communion with them, but it's close. In the case of the Protestant community, not all of the sacraments are the same. And so consequently, there's not as great a degree of unity. Also, there's more theological differences between the Protestant churches and the Catholic Church. And so there's not as much compatibility theologically either. You move beyond that, Jewish people have elements that they share in common with the Catholic Church. There are aspects of Judaism that are compatible with the Catholic faith and with the Catholic Church. And even more broadly beyond that, throughout all of humanity, because we have a common human nature and because God works in one way or another in everyone's life, there are aspects everywhere that are compatible. So it's a question of degree, not so much is something compatible or not compatible. It's a question of in what ways is it compatible and in what ways is it not compatible. If, to get to the second question, there is a sense in which the Catholic Church uniquely has all of the elements that Christ willed his church to have. According to the teaching of the church, though, Christ Church is operative in other Christian communities, but it only subsists in the Catholic Church. And if a non-Catholic church were to become fully compatible with the Catholic Church, to use the language we're using at the moment, if it came to agree with the Catholic Church on all of the sacraments, all of the means of grace, all of the points of faith and so forth, if it became fully compatible with the Catholic Church, then it would together with the Catholic Church discover we're in communion with each other, and it would be part of the Catholic Church. And there have been cases in history where various churches that for a time had been separate from the Catholic Church then rediscovered full unity with the Catholic Church and became part of it. And so they're part of it today.
Donald, thank you very, very much for your question. We go now to Ray in Peoria, Illinois, listening on WPMJ 94.3 FM. Ray, your question for Jimmy.
Good evening, Jimmy and Cy. How are you guys doing today?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Really appreciate your work in helping to share the Catholic faith and to help to educate us. And question I have relates to our Mass. On Sunday, our priest consecrates both species, both bread and wine, into the body and blood of Christ. And there's a discussion about how much wine should be prepared, as the sacristans prepare for the Mass ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, the way it's being prepared, there's almost a half a cup of consecrated wine in each of the four chalices that we use,
mm-hmm.
which has caused some of the Eucharistic ministers to be like, oh, that's a bit much for me to consume.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we've got this shuffle at the end with people asking for help mm-hmm. to consume that. And I was just trying to find if there were any guidelines. I was looking online at the general instruction of the Roman Missal, and I couldn't, I couldn't find anything there that could give any guidance on that. And I was wondering if
there's no specific guidance, and the reason is that the circumstances vary too much from one location where Mass is being celebrated to another. If you've got a whole bunch of people coming to receive the precious blood and you don't have a lot of people distributing it, then that means each person who is distributing the precious blood needs to have more of it. And there's no practical way to provide a concrete amount of guidance on that. So it's left to the discretion of the principally to the celebrating priest and the pastor of the parish to figure out what's an appropriate amount to direct the sacristans to prepare. So it really is a prudential question, and if too much is being left to comfortably consume and it's causing an issue to have multiple people consuming it, which is the thing you're supposed to do if there's too much for one person to consume, then it would simply be appropriate to talk to the pastor and say, hey, we're having a little too much left over. Is there a way we can moderate the amount at least until circumstances change?
Thank you very much, Ray. Michael in Lafayette, Indiana, watching on Facebook Live, is next. Michael, your question for Jimmy.
Hello, thank you. Some atheists will, in their arguments, they'll say, oh, you know, the universe and the world, it has some imperfections in it. Like, real quickly, for example, they say, like, oh, the tube in your throat, it's used for breathing and eating. So if there are two tubes, then, you know, you could... You would not choke.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious to know, Jimmy, what you would say about, you know, atheists who say there's, you know, these perfections in the world, as they call them.
Imperfections, you mean?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, I'd say a couple things. The first one is that we have to be really careful about what we would say is an imperfection, because just because something has one limitation doesn't mean that it doesn't also have benefits. For example, you could look at the fact that we have one tube going down our throat, which both serves for breathing and for eating. You could look at that as an asset. Hey, that's more efficient.
Yeah.
Because we only have to grow this one tube as part of our biology, we therefore don't have to expend the energy and the genetic space to encode the instructions to build a second one. And so consequently, there are advantages to having just one tube in our case. There are trade-offs. Does that mean that that there aren't also drawbacks? No, it is possible for us to choke because of the one tube. What happens? I mean, ultimately, it splits in two. You know, you have the esophagus and the trachea, but they both go through our mouth. Well, imagine if you had to build a whole separate structure to accommodate two tubes. That's going to take up biological resources, including genetic space in our genes, and also food, and there's going to be developmental time associated with that. Inevitably, in biology, if you build one thing, there's a set of trade-offs you're making. And so that makes it really hard to look at something and say, ooh, that's just an imperfection, because it almost never is. If it was something that was just a fatal imperfection and there were no trade-offs, then whatever has the fatal imperfection would die. And so so from a scientific viewpoint, even if you take God out of it and attribute all of this to just blind evolution, evolution made these trade-offs because they were successful. And if an organism from an evolutionary perspective is adapted to its present environment, then that's a successful organism, and it's not something you can just say is an imperfection or a mistake. It's successfully adapted to this environment, and that's the only criterion of success in evolutionary terms. Does it work in this environment such that it lives long enough to reproduce, typically? And so I would say, just from a from an evolutionary perspective, even without bringing God into it, it's really hard to just say something's a mistake or a flaw. There's always trade-offs. But then to bring God back into it, if evolution can make these trade-offs, God can also make these trade-offs in designing us. And regardless of the process he used to do that, regardless of what role evolution played as part of his providence, he can make those trade-offs. And as we covered in our earlier discussion of the problem of evil, he can bring good and will bring good out of every evil, including cases where people accidentally choke.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks very much for that. I still wish when I go snorkeling, it would be so convenient to have a blowhole in the back.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
just keep your face down. And
well, then you could drown through your blowhole, though. Think
dolphins
of the dolphins.
Do dolphins drown?
Got questions? Visit us today at Catholic.com.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture's moral center continues to fly apart, and with every form of deviance publicly aired and celebrated, we have no choice but to equip our kids to understand about such issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. Silence can no longer be an option. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging on to the shop at Catholic.com.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
I'm Gloria Purvis.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team talks about food, football, and faith.
Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, Cy.
I'm back to being friends with Gloria Purvis. Well, if we can be friends again now, because she keeps saying hi to me. 888-318-7884 is our number here. We've solved the problem during the break of dolphins drowning. Apparently, mm-hmm. We didn't really solve that problem.
They'll drown like anybody else. They're air breathers.
I think tuna nets can drown mm-hmm. a dolphin. I think that's something that happens in tuna nets sometimes.
Uh-huh.
I think they have new tuna nets that don't do that, though. Mm-hmm. 888-31.
Maybe that's how they get so-called dolphin-safe tuna.
Yes, right. Yeah. I'm so hungry now, Jimmy. Not for dolphin.
For tuna?
Yeah.
Sorry, Charlie.
All right, let's go to George in Santa Rosa, California. Help me, George. What's your question for Jimmy?
Jimmy. Hello, Cy. I phoned in last year, and I had asked you a question regarding Ronald Reagan.
Okay.
And just I believe in truth and advertising. I am a Protestant, so okay. I realize we have some serious theological issues.
What's your question
last
today?
Year I read Paul Kinger's tome about Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II. It was called A Pope and a President.
Okay.
About how United States officially reestablished diplomatic relations with the Vatican back in January 1984,
okay.
35 years ago. Now, as I said, I'm a Protestant, and I realize there are several different strands of it, but I'm 49 years old. I'm going to be turning 50 next month. Mm-hmm. And I just, yeah, at the time, I just wasn't really up on politics or current events, and I was totally oblivious as to when that actually happened. Yeah.
Okay, George, I'm not sure where you're going with this. Can you phrase it in the form of a question?
Okay, why? Okay, so the rationale for, according to Kinger, for that, why Ronald Reagan did that is because the U.S. and the Vatican needed to work together to fight against Russia.
Okay,
against USSR. The Soviet Union, yeah.
And some people could debate as to whether that was necessary. However, America, since its inception, was supposed to be a religiously neutral country, even though historically we've been mostly Protestant.
So do you want Jimmy to justify the fact that we have American diplomatic relations with the Vatican? Are you looking for an answer to that? Why do we have that?
Well, yes. And why is that? And why shouldn't Protestants be up in arms about that?
Fair enough.
Okay. So one has to distinguish between two entities. One is the Vatican City State, which is a government. With its own territory. It happens to be the smallest state in the world, but it is a government with its own territory, Vatican City State, hence the name, and the Catholic Church, which is not a government, and the Catholic faith, which is held by the Catholic Church, which is also not a government. So when the United States established diplomatic relations with, quote-unquote, the Vatican – that people use as shorthand for the headquarters of the church. What it really was doing was establishing diplomatic relations with another government, the Vatican City State, just like it has relationships with other governments all over the world. Some of those governments have an official religion. For example, when in the case of Vatican City State, obviously the official religion of the like 1,000 people who are actually citizens of Vatican City State, the official religion of Vatican City State is obviously Catholicism. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean the U.S. government endorses Catholicism for all of its citizens. In the same way, Saudi Arabia. The official religion there is Islam. Mm-hmm. But the fact we have diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia doesn't mean the United States is mandating Islam for all of its people. So that's the answer in terms of the diplomatic relations question. We can go a little further, though, and say what does it mean for what does this so-called separation of church and state actually mean? That phrase, separation of church and state, is actually not found in the Constitution. What the Constitution does is it provides that Congress – this is the First Amendment – that Congress shall not make any law respecting the establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, what does this mean? To understand what a text means, you have to read it in its original context. What did these words mean to the original audience, to the men who wrote them?
Yeah.
And when you talk to it, back then in the 1780s when the Constitution was written and when the Bill of Rights was written talking about an establishment of religion meant creating a national church, because that's what was the case in England. The so-called established church was the Anglican Church, an official state church. And so what the Constitution said was that the United States Congress cannot establish a national church. And that's all it said. It did not say that it did not say states cannot establish state churches.
All right. There were state churches at the time.
Yeah. It just meant you can't have a national one that Congress does. It also did not say governors or presidents or individual congressmen can't say, hey, everybody ought to be my religion.
Mm-hmm.
There's no prohibition on evangelization there.
Yeah.
And so, so consequently – it's in terms of what the Constitution actually allows and what the founders were envisioning, it was just we're not going to have a Church of America,
but that didn't mean that the government couldn't favor different religions or promote more than one religion. And it certainly didn't mean there had to be a rigid exclusion of religious life from politics.
There is a Protestant country where the head of state is the head of the religion, and we have diplomatic relations with them.
Yeah, I think it's called the United Kingdom.
Oh, yeah, that's right. United Kingdom. George, thank you very, very much. I'm going to go to Myra now in Alabama, listening on Sirius XM satellite radio to EWTN channel 130. Myra, your question for Jimmy.
Yay. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me all right?
Yes. Your question?
Okay, good. So this is my question. Several years ago, there was a very prominent Catholic priest in Miami. And unfortunately, he left the Catholic priesthood, got married, and subsequently became an Episcopalian priest.
Okay.
So my question is, when, of course, the Episcopalian mass or whatever service, very similar to the Catholic mass.
Yes.
So whenever he is saying the Eucharistic prayer, does that bread and wine really turn into the body and blood of Christ? Because he was an ordained priest.
Right. The answer is that because he has ordination that's valid, as long as he is using the correct matter, you know, valid matter, and as long as he's using a valid form of words, and as long as he has a valid intention, at least generally, to do what the church does in this sacrament, then, yeah, it's going to be valid. And so that's one reason that when talking about the Eucharist in Anglican churches, you'll often hear me say things like Anglican orders are generally not valid unless a particular priest has converted from a church where they are valid, like the Catholic Church or an Orthodox Church or the Assyrian Church of the East or something like that.
Well, that is unfortunate. I thought as much, but I'm saddened to hear that, because then now, do you know, really quick follow-up question, do you know, because I've never been to an Episcopalian mass, I don't know anything about their liturgy, are their words?
They're not exactly identical, but they express the same substance of thought. And it's not like the words, by divine law, there doesn't have to be just one set of words. If you look within the Catholic Church and you look at different Catholic churches, like, you know, the Latin Church and the Chaldean Church and the Maronite Church and the Melkite Church, they use slightly different formulas of consecration, but they all express that this is Jesus's body and this is Jesus's blood, and they all invoke the Holy Spirit to come down on the elements and transform them. And so so it's not like there has to be an exact set of words for a valid consecration. Not that there has to be a single set of words for a valid consecration, but the thoughts have to be expressed. And in the Anglican liturgy, the words that are used do express those thoughts.
Myra, thank you very, very much for that call. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with more right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. I am Cy Kellett, your host. I don't know what's going on with the voice. It's coming in and out. I don't know what it is. I apologize for it. Let's go to Isaiah in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Isaiah, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. So it's in our faith that the souls in purgatory rely on our prayers to be released from purgatory.
No.
No.
No. It's in our faith that our prayers can assist them, but not that they have to have them. They don't require them.
Okay. Because ultimately it's God.
Yep.
God's power that releases them.
That's
okay.
Right.
So I guess going along with that, then, at the end of time, at that final judgment, is it simply God's power that releases those souls that are judged for purgatory? Or how does that work at the end of time when there's no one left on earth to offer those prayers?
Well, there will still be people in existence, and so it's possible that the blessed will be praying for those who are being transformed at that moment. But it's not essential that that happen. God doesn't need our prayers to purify someone in purgatory any more than he needs our prayers to cause something to happen in general. He can do it just because he's a good God. And so for everybody who goes to purgatory, it's just a temporary cleansing. It may or may not be extended in time. But however it happens, it's God that does it. No doubt the Son and the Holy Spirit both intercede for people who are experiencing that purification with the Father, intercede with the Father for people experiencing the purification because they intercede for Christians in general, according to the New Testament. And it's possible that the people who are already in heaven will be praying for people being purified. It's possible that people on earth will be praying, or who are, you know, on the renovated new earth will be praying for people who are being purified, or depending on your chronology. I mean, it's possible for people who haven't died to be praying for those who are in purgatory. And it's even possible that people in purgatory are praying for themselves, because anybody can ask God. Even demons ask God things, and he allows them. Read the book of Job, or read the encounter with the Gadarene demoniac.
Yeah, make us go into them.
Yeah.
All right. Isaiah, thank you for that very interesting question. We go now to John in Rochester, New York, listening on 92.9 FM. John, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, my question actually has to do with John Paul II.
Okay.
And I have been listening to a teacher from a seminary in Florida. His name is Ryan Reeves from the Gordon Conwell Seminary.
Okay.
I'm not sure that
I'm not familiar with him. I am familiar with
Catholic or not.
Probably not. Gordon Conwell is a Presbyterian seminary or Protestant seminary.
Okay. In any case, Ryan Reeves had made a claim that during the Italian Mass in 2004, that John Paul II and the Patriarch of Constantinople had gotten together for the Mass and recited the Nicene Creed in Greek, leaving out the Filioque.
Filioque,
And I was wondering if there's any truth to that, and if so, if there's any implications from that.
I believe he did. I'd have to, look it up just to verify, but that would be my understanding. The reason is that there's a couple of reasons, but one of them is that the Eastern Orthodox followed a different course of doctrinal development, and they don't include the filioque clause in their version of the creed. Filioque is from the Latin filius, meaning son, and the enclitic que, which you tack on to the end, it means and. So filioque means and the son. It's the part of the creed where we say that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. That's filioque in Latin. But in the East, they didn't follow that same doctrinal development trajectory, so they don't use it in their version of the creed. And so if you're trying to arrange an event where John Paul II is praying with the Patriarch of Constantinople and they're going to say the creed together, which version of the creed are they going to use? Well, they're going to use one they can both agree on. And so they could both say the Greek creed just fine without the filioque, even though from John Paul II would say, as a Catholic, I believe the filioque, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
that doesn't mean that if I that I have to mention it on every single occasion.
Yeah.
And so consequently, you know, as an expression of joint Christian faith, they prayed the version of the creed that was acceptable to both. Furthermore, if memory serves, the Holy See has actually indicated that when the creed is said in Greek, the filioque is not to be used because the because there's a potential misleading connotation in Greek that they want to avoid. And so even in Eastern Catholic churches that are in full communion with the Pope, when they say the creed in Greek, they don't use the filioque in Latin that is used in Latin. They don't use the Greek equivalent of that because it could have a potentially misleading implication when it's said in Greek. At least that's my memory of the reason.
Okay, John.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Brandon in Dallas, Texas, listening on 910 AM. You are up next. Your question, Brandon.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. What's your question?
My wife and I are coming into the church this Easter Vigil.
Congratulations.
And thank you. We're really excited about it. And we've heard some conflicting information. Some people have told us that we need to have our marriage blessed or something to be validated. Some people have told us we don't need that.
Okay. Let me ask you some questions then. Have either one of you been married to another person before your present marriage?
No.
Okay. So this is a first marriage for both of you?
Correct.
Has either one of you ever been Catholic before?
No.
Okay. In that case, you were not bound by the church's requirement that Catholics get married in the church or get a dispensation. And so since neither one of you is married to someone else, you're presumably free to marry each other. You didn't have a requirement to get married in the Catholic Church. And so the church would presume that your marriage is valid. And so you would not need to get it convalidated or blessed or anything like that.
Good. Okay. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thanks, Brandon, and congratulations. That's just great news. Trooper in Lake Travis, Texas, listening on 88.5 FM. You are up next. Your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Si, Jimmy.
Hi, Trooper.
I sure enjoyed meeting y'all at the conference.
Thank you.
You coming again?
Oh, yeah, man. It's going to be an every year thing for me. Y'all are like the best of California and the best of the Catholics.
You're just too kind.
A pleasant atmosphere. Anyway, I got a battle going. I've got a Buddhist friend, and then my son-in-law's a hardcore Baptist. And my Buddhist friend threw this at me about you can't go into the temple mutilated. So therefore, it's all kind of mumbo jumbo. So I didn't know what to think at first. And then I got thinking, well, we're under the new law. But in the meantime, I asked my Baptist son-in-law, and he came back with something between the lines. The answer was pretty much the same about the new law, but he said, in this matter now, we're no longer bringing sacrifices to the temple and no longer have a mortal priesthood.
So
I know he's going to come at me about that's what we have going.
Okay. So it's true that we're no longer offering animal sacrifices, but we are offering other kinds of sacrifices. We're also not bound to the Jewish temple, which has been destroyed. But we are offering some sacrifices to God. If you want to show that to your son-in-law, look at Romans chapter 12, where Paul says that we offer ourselves as living sacrifices to God. And that's just a place where he's explicit about it. The Eucharist is also a sacrifice, though it's not as explicitly so. But in Romans 12, it's absolutely explicit. We're offering ourselves to God as living sacrifices. So there are sacrifices that Christians continue to offer. They're not animal sacrifices, though. In terms of is there a priesthood, well, Christ is our high priest, and we all share a common priesthood, and according to the New Testament. And if you look at the Old Testament, you find there was a high priest, And all of the people were a kingdom of priests, but then there was also a middle ministerial priesthood of people who were ministers of God. And so the question becomes, well, if we have that top high priest and that bottom kingdom of priests in the New Testament, is there also a middle priesthood for God's ministers? And you know what? You look in Romans, and Paul, who is a minister of God, says that he's been called to do the priestly work of preaching the gospel so that the Gentiles may be an acceptable offering to God. So there's another sacrifice for you, and St. Paul is conceptualizing New Testament ministers as priests.
Trooper, thanks very, very much for that call.
By the way, if you want more on that, take a look at jimmyakin.com. I have a document on the priest. It's called The Priesthood Debate, where I deal with this. And also, we have an audio set I did with a former Catholic priest called The Priesthood Debate on this subject.
Thanks, Trooper. Let's go to Sergio in Washington. Sergio, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. God bless you. My question is about Isaiah. Chapter 13.
Okay.
Verse, I think it's from 5 to 10.
Okay.
Where Isaiah is talking about to those who are arriving from a far off land, from the heights of the heavens, it is the Lord and the instruments of his fury, so that he may bring ruin to all the earth. My question to that is that, is Isaiah talking about another civilization from another world coming to planet Earth?
No, it would be cool if he was, but we can be confident here that he's not. In verse 5, it does mention this group coming in connection with the heavens, but it doesn't say from the heights of heaven. It says from the ends of the heavens. And so what that's envisioning is you think of all the earth is covered by the heavens. And so to say someone is coming from the ends of the heavens means they're coming from a really far away point on earth that is like at the ends of the heavens, where the heavens run out. So like the edge of the earth. That's the metaphor that's being used here. And we can be confident that that's what's meant here, because the group is expressly identified at the beginning of this chapter. This whole section in Isaiah chapter 13 is one prophecy, what's known as an oracle. It's a single prophetic speech, and we're told who it's directed against. If you read Isaiah 13:1, it says a prophecy against Babylon that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw. And so what Isaiah is doing is prophesying that the Babylonians, who come from a far distant land, are going to invade and be instruments of God's wrath and so forth.
So, Sergio, you were thinking it might be an alien invasion?
Yes.
It is, but in the human sense of alien, not the extraterrestrial sense.
So the ends of the heavens is basically synonymous with the ends of the earth, because that's where they meet.
Yeah.
Okay. Sergio, thank you very, very much for that call. 888. Oh, I don't need to give out the number here. Let's see. Let's go to Haas in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. You got to be really quick, Haas, and I know you can do it.
Yeah, Jimmy, I just wanted to ask you, if I'm thinking about end of life kind of thing. So is death natural to the human person? And I mean that, like, we used to have preternatural gifts of, like, immortality. We lost that due to the original sin. So obviously we don't need it because it's not part of our essence. But in your opinion, do you think death is natural to the human person?
And Well, sorry, I got to let Jimmy answer.
I think it depends on the perspective you're talking from. In one sense, death is natural, because any natural or physical system will break down over the course of time due to the effects of entropy. And that's a kind of modern way of saying it, but the principle was acknowledged by Aquinas that any natural body is going to break down over time unless it's supported by God's grace. Now, because God gave us the opportunity to be immortal and not die, you could say, well, there's a sense in which it's not natural for us, but that's an accommodated sense, because that was a preternatural gift, something beyond or in addition to what would naturally happen to our physical bodies. So I think that it's going to depend on how you're using the word natural, but in the more fundamental sense, death is natural for a physical body, but fortunately God has something better for us.
Thank you very much, Haas, for that question. Thank you, Jimmy, for 2 hours of hard work. Appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Tomorrow, we're taking this show on the road. We'll have Trent Horn with us. We'll have Steve Ray with us. We've got Father, Monsignor Eugene Morris, second hour. You're going to love it. But Darren, Marie, and I are taking the show on the road. So we'll let you know about that tomorrow when we see you, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.